Once Santan's preoccupation with the necklace was over and her strength and vitality fully recovered after childbirth, she began to find the days too long and the rock cliffs of the valley as restrictive as the high walls of a prison. The daily routine of life was undemanding, and Shasa slept on her hip or strapped to her back while she gathered the fallen nuts in the grove, or helped Tani bring in the firewood. Her menses resumed their courses, and she itched with unexpected energy. She had sudden moods of black depression, when even Hani's innocent chatter irritated her, and she went off alone with the baby. Though he slept soundly through it all, she held him on her lap and spoke to him in French or English. She told him about his father and the chateau, about Nuage and Anna and General Courtney, and the names and the memories instilled in her a deep and undirected melancholy. Sometimes in the night, when she could not sleep, she lay and listened to the music in her head, the strains of Aida or the songs the peasants sang in the fields at Mortom during the Vendang. So the months passed and the seasons of the desert rotated. The Mongongo tree flowered and fruited again, and one day Shasa lifted himself onto hands and knees and, to the delight of all, set off on his own first explorations of the valley. Yet Santan's mood swung more violently than the seasons. Her joy in Shasa and her contentment in the old people's company alternating with blacker moods when she felt like a life prisoner in the valley. "They have come here to die," she realized as she saw how the old San had settled into an established routine. "But I don't want to die. I want to live. To live!" Hani watched her shrewdly until she realized it was time, and then told Owa, "Tomorrow Namchild and I are going out of the valley." "Why, old woman?" Owa looked startled. He was entirely contented, and had not yet thought about leaving. "We need medicines and a change of food. That is no reason to risk passing the guardians of the tunnel. We will go out in the cool of the dawn, when the bees are sleepy, and return in the late evening. Besides, the guardians have accepted us." Owa started to protest further, but she cut him short. "It is necessary, old grandfather. There are things that a man does not understand." As Hani had intended, Santan was excited and happy with the promised outing, and she shook Hani awake long before the agreed hour. They slipped quietly through the tunnel of the bees, and with Shasa bound tightly to her back and her carrying satchel slung over one shoulder, Santan ran down the narrow valley and out into the endless spaces of the desert like a schoolchild, released from the classroom. Her mood lasted through the morning, and she and Hani chattered happily, and they moved through the forest searching and digging for the roots that Hani said she needed. In the heat of the noonday, they found shelter under an acacia, and while Santan nursed the baby, Hani curled up in the shade and slept like an old yellow cat. Once Shasa had drunk his fill, Santan leaned back against the trunk of the acacia and dozed off as well. The stamp of hooves and horsey snorts disturbed her, and she opened her eyes but remained absolutely still. With the breeze behind them, a herd of zebra had gazed down upon the sleeping group, not noticing them in the waist-high grass. There were at least 100 animals in the herd, newly born foals with legs too long for their fluffy bodies and with smudged chocolate-coloured stripes not yet set into definite patterns, staying close to their dams and staring around at the world with huge, dark, apprehensive eyes, older foals, quick and sure-footed, as they chased each other in circles through the trees, the breeding mares, sleek and glossy, with stiff, upstanding manes and pricked ears, some of them huge with foal, milk already swelling in their black udders. Then there were the stallions, with powerful, bulging quarters, necks arched proudly as they challenged each other, or snuffled one of the mares, reminding Santenne vividly of Nuage in his prime. Barely daring to breathe, she lay against the acacia trunk and watched them with deep pleasure. They moved down still closer. She could have reached out and touched one of the foals as it gambolled past her. They passed so close that she could see that each animal was different from the others, the intricate patterns of their hides as distinct as fingerprints, and the dark stripes were shadowed by a paler, orangey cream duplicate, so that every animal was a separate work of art. As she watched, one of the stallions, a magnificent animal standing 12 hands and with a bushy tail sweeping below his hocks, cut a young mare out of the main pack of the herd, nipping at her flanks and her neck with square yellow teeth, heading her off when she tried to circle back, pushing her well away from the other mares but closer to the acacia tree before he started to gentle her by nuzzling her neck. The mare bridled flirtatiously, well aware of her highly desirable condition, and she rolled her eyes and bit him viciously on his muscled, glossy shoulder, so that he snorted and reared away, but then circled back and tried to push his nose up under her tail where she was swollen tensely with her season. She squealed with a modest outrage and lashed out with both back legs, her shiny black hooves flying high past his head, and she spun around to face him, baring her teeth. Santenne found herself unaccountably moved. She shared the mare's mounting excitation, empathized with her charade of reluctance that was spurring the circling stallion to greater ardour. At last the mare submitted and stood stock still, her tail lifted as the stallion nosed her, gently. Santenne felt her own body stiffen in anticipation. Then, when the stallion reared over her and buried his long, pulsing black root deeply in her, Santenne gasped and pressed her own knees together sharply. That night, in her rude, thatched shelter, beside the steaming thermal pool, she dreamed of Michael and the old barn near North Field, and woke to a deep, corroding loneliness and an undirected discontent that did not subside even when she held Shasa to her breast and felt him tugging demandingly at her. Her dark mood persisted, and the high rocky walls of the valley closed in around her so she felt she could not breathe. However, 4 more days passed before she could wheedle Harney into another expedition out into the open forests. Santenne looked for the zebra herd again as they meandered amongst the mopani trees, but this time the forest seemed strangely deserted, and what wild game they did see was mistrusting and skittish, taking instant alarm at the first distant sight of the upright human figures. "There is something," Harney muttered as they rested in the noon heat. "I do not know what it is, but the wild things sense it also. It makes me uneasy. We should return to the valley that I might talk with Owa. He understands these things better than I do." "Oh, Harney, not yet," Santenne pleaded. "Let us stay here a little longer. I feel so free. I do not like whatever is happening out here," Harney insisted. "The bees," Santenne found inspiration. "We cannot pass through the tunnel until nightfall." And though Harney grumped and frowned, she at last agreed. "But listen to this old woman. There is something unusual, something bad." And she sniffed at the air, and neither of them could sleep when they rested at noon. Harney took Shasa from her as soon as he had fed. "He grows so," she whispered, and there was a shadow of regret in her bright black eyes. "I wish I could see him in his full growth, straight and tall as the mopani tree." "You will, old grandmother," Santenne smiled. "You will live to see him as a man." Harney did not look up at her. "You will go, both of you, one day soon. I sense it. You will go back to your own people." Her voice was hoarse with regret. "You will go, and when you do, there will be nothing left in life for this old woman." "No, old grandmother." Santenne reached out and took her hand. "Perhaps we will have to go one day. But we will come back to you. I give you my word on that." Gently, Harney disentangled her grip and still without looking at Santan stood up. The heat is past. They worked back towards the mountain, moving widely separated through the forest, keeping each other just in sight, except when denser bush intervened. As was her habit, Santan chatted to the sleeping infant on her hip, speaking French to train his ear to the sound of the language and to keep her own tongue exercised. They had almost reached the scree slope below the cliffs when Santan saw the fresh tracks of a pair of zebra stallions imprinted deeply in the soft earth ahead of her. Under Hani's instruction, she had developed acute powers of observation, and Owa had taught her to read the signs of the wild with fluent ease. There was something about these tracks that puzzled her. They ran side by side, as though the animals that made them had been harnessed to each other. She hefted Shasa onto her other hip and turned aside to examine them more closely. She stopped with a jerk that alarmed the child, and he squawked in protest. Santan stood paralyzed with shock, staring at the hoofprints, not yet able to comprehend what she was seeing. Then, suddenly, a rush of emotions and understanding made her reel back. She understood the agitated behaviour of the wild creatures, and Hani's undirected premonition of evil. She began to tremble, at the same moment filled with fear and joy, with confusion and shaking excitement. "Shasa," she whispered, "they are not zebra prints." The hooves that had made these chains of tracks were shod with crescents of steel. "Horsemen, Shasa. Civilized men riding horses shod with steel." It seemed impossible. Not here. Not in this desert fastness. Instinctively, her hands flew to the opening of the canvas shawl she wore about her shoulders, and from which her breasts thrust out unashamedly. She covered them and glanced around her fearfully. With the sand, she had come to accept nudity as completely natural. Now she was aware that her skirts rode high on her long, slim thighs, and she was ashamed. She backed away from the prince as though from an accuser's finger. "Men, a civilized man," she repeated, and immediately the image of Michael formed in her mind, and a longing overcame her shame. She crept forward again and knelt beside the spoor, staring at it avidly, not able to bring herself to touch it in case it proved to be hallucination. It was fresh, so very fresh that even as she watched the crisply outlined edge of one hoofprint, it collapsed and slid in upon itself in a trickle of loose sand. "An hour ago, Shasa. They passed only an hour ago, not longer." The riders had been walking their horses, moving at less than 5 miles an hour. "There is a civilized man within 5 miles of us at this very moment, Shasa." She jumped up and ran along the line, 50 paces, before she stopped again and dropped to her knees. She would not have seen it before. Without Owa's instruction, she had been blind, but now she picked out the alien texture of metal, even though it was only the size of a thumbnail and had fallen into a clump of dry grass. She picked it out and laid it in her palm. It was a tarnished brass button, a military button with an embossed crest and the broken thread still knotted in the tang. She stared at it as though it were a priceless jewel. The design upon it depicted a unicorn and an antelope guarding a shield, and below there was a motto in a ribbon. "Ex unitate vires," she read aloud. She had seen the same buttons on General Sean Courtney's tunic, but his were brightly polished. "From unity strength, the coat of arms of the Union of South Africa." "A soldier, Shasa, one of General Courtney's men?" At that moment, there was a distant whistle. Hani's summons, and Santan sprang to her feet and hovered undecidedly. All her instinct was to race desperately after the horsemen, and to plead to be allowed to travel with them back to civilization. But then Harney whistled again, and she turned to look back. She knew how terrified the San were of all foreigners, for the old people had told her all the stories of brutal persecution. Harney must not see these tracks. She shaded her eyes and stared longingly in the direction in which the spoor pointed, but nothing moved amongst the mapani trees. "She will try to stop us following them, Shasa. She and Owa will do anything to stop us. How can we leave the old people? And yet they can't come with us. They will be in great danger." She was torn and undecided. "But we can't let this chance go. It might be our only..." Harney whistled again, this time much closer, and Santan saw her small figure amongst the trees coming towards her. Santan's hand closed guiltily on the brass button, and she thrust it into the bottom of her satchel. "Harney mustn't see the tracks," she repeated, and glanced quickly up at the cliffs, orientating herself so that she could return and find them herself, and then she whirled and ran to meet the old woman and led her away back towards the hidden valley. That evening, as they performed the routine camp chores, Santan had difficulty disguising the nervous excitement that gripped her, and she replied distractedly to Harney's questions. As soon as they had eaten and the short African dusk ended, she went to her shelter and settled down as though to sleep, pulling the chemsbok skin over both the infant and herself. Although she lay quietly and regulated her breathing, she was fretting and worrying as she tried to reach her decision. She had no means of guessing who the horsemen were, and she was determined not to lead the San into mortal danger, yet she was equally determined to take her own chances and to follow up those tantalizing tracks for the promise they held of salvation and return to her own world, of escape from this harsh existence which would at last turn her and her infant into savages. "We must give ourselves a start so that we can catch up with the horsemen before Annie and Owa even realize we have gone. That way they will not follow us, will not be exposed to danger. We will go as soon as the moon rises, my baby." She lay tense and still, feigning sleep, until the gibbous moon showed over the rim of the valley. Then she rose quietly, and Shasa murmured and grunted sleepily as she gathered up her satchel and stave and crept quietly out onto the path. She paused at the corner of the hill and looked back. The fire had died to embers, but the moonlight played into the old people's shelter. Owa was in the shadows, just a small dark shape, but the moonlight washed Hani. Her amber skin seemed to glow in the soft light, and her head, propped on her own shoulder, was turned towards Santan. Her expression seemed forlorn and hopeless, a harbinger of the terrible sorrow and loss that Santan knew she would suffer when she woke, and the necklace of pebbles gleamed dully on her bony old chest. "Goodbye, old grandmother," Santan whispered. "Thank you for your great humanity and kindness to us. I will always love you. Forgive us, little Hani, but we have to go." Santan had to steel herself before she could turn the rocky corner that cut her off from the camp. As she turned up the rough pathway to the tunnel of the bees, her own tears blurred the moonlight and tasted of seawater as they ran into the corners of her mouth. She groped her way through the utter darkness and the warm honey smell of the tunnel and out into the moonlight in the narrow valley beyond. She paused to listen for the sound of bare feet on the rocks behind her, but the only sound was the yelp of the jackal packs out on the plains below, and she started forward again. As she reached the plain, Shasa mewed and wriggled on her hip, and without stopping, she adjusted his sling so that he could reach her breast. He fastened on it greedily, and she whispered to him as she hurried through the forest, "Don't be afraid, baby. Even though this is the first time we have been alone at night, The horsemen will be camped just a short way ahead. We will catch up with them before sunrise, before Hani and Owa are even awake. Don't look at the shadows. Don't imagine things, Shasa. She kept talking softly, trying to shore up her own courage, for the night was full of mystery and menace, and she had never realized until that moment how she had come to rely on the two old people.
We should have found this spur by now, Shasa.
Santan stopped uncertainly and peered about her. Everything looked different in the moonlight.
We must have missed it.
She turned back, breaking into an anxious trot.
I'm sure it was at the head of the glade.
And then with a rush of relief.
There it is.
The moon was against us before. Now the hoofprints were rimmed clearly with shadow, and the steel shoes had bitten deeply into the sandy earth. How much Owa had taught her. She saw the track so clearly that she could break into a trot. The horsemen had made no effort to hide their spur, and there was no wind to wipe it out. They had ridden the easy line, keeping out in the open, following well-beaten game paths, not pushing their mounts above an easy ambling walk, and once Santen found where one of them had dismounted and led his horse for a short distance. She was elated when she saw that this man wore boots, riding boots with medium-high heels and well-worn soles. Even in the uncertain moonlight, Santan could tell by the length of his stride and the slight toe-out gait that he was a tall man, with long, narrow feet and an easy yet confident stride. It seemed to confirm all her hopes.
"Wait for us," she whispered. "Please, sir, wait for Shasa and me to catch up."
She was gaining rapidly.
"We must look for their campfire, Shasa. They will be camped not far from—"
She broke off.
"There! What's that, Shasa? Did you see it?"
She stared into the forest.
"I'm sure I saw something."
She stared about her.
"But it's gone now."
She changed Shasa to her other hip.
"What a big lump you are becoming. But never mind, we'll be there soon."
She started forward again, and the trees thinned out, and Santen found herself at the head of another long open glade. The moonlight laid a pale metallic sheen on the short grass. Eagerly, she surveyed the open ground, focusing her attention on each dark irregularity, hoping to see hobbled horses near a smouldering fire and human beings' shapes rolled into their blankets. But the shapes were only tree stumps or anthills, and at the far side of the glade a small herd of wildebeest grazing heads down.
"Don't worry, Shasa,"
she spoke louder to cover her own intense disappointment.
"I'm sure they'll be camped in the trees."
The wildebeest threw up their heads and erupted into a rumbling, snorting stampede, streaming away into the trees, fine dust hanging behind them like mist.
"What frightened them, Shasa? The wind is with us. They could not have taken our scent."
Sound of the running herd dwindled.
"Something chased them."
She looked around her carefully.
"I'm imagining things. I'm seeing things that aren't there. We mustn't start panicking at shadows."
Santan started forward firmly, but within a short distance she stopped again, fearfully.
"Did you hear that, Shasa? There is something following us. I heard the footfalls, but it stopped now. It's watching us. I can feel it."
At that moment, a small cloud passed over the moon, and the world turned dark.
"The moon will come out again soon."
Santen hugged the infant so hard that Shasa gave a little bleat of protest.
"I'm sorry, baby."
She relaxed her grip and then stumbled as she started forward.
"I wish we hadn't come." "No, that's not true. We had to come. We must be brave, Shasa. We can't follow the spoor without the moon."
She sank down to rest, looking up into the sky. The moon was a pale nimbus through the thin gunmetal cloud, and then it broke out into a hole in the cloud layer and for a moment flooded the glade with soft platinum light.
"Shasa!"
Santan's voice rose into a high, thin scream. There was something out there, a huge, pale shape, as big as a horse, but with a sinister, stealthy, unhorse-like carriage. At a cry, it sank out of sight below the tops of the grass. Santan leapt to her feet and raced towards the trees, but before she reached them, the moon was snuffed out again, and in the darkness, Santan fell full length. Shasa wailed fretfully against her chest, "Please be quiet, baby." Santan hugged him, but the child sensed her terror and screamed, "Don't, Shasa, you'll bring it after us." Santan was trembling wildly. That big, pale thing out there in the darkness was possessed of an unearthly menace, a palpable aura of evil, and she knew what it was. She had seen it before. She pressed herself flat to the earth, trying to cover Shasa with her own body. Then there was a sound, a hurricane of sound that filled the night, filled her head, seemed to fill her very soul. She had heard that sound before, but never so close, never so soul-shattering. "O sweet mother of God," she whispered. It was the full-blooded roar of a lion, the most terrifying sound of the African wilds. At that moment, the moon broke out of the cloud again, and she saw the lion clearly. It stood facing her, 50 paces away, and it was immense, with its mane fully extended, a peacock's tail of ruddy hair around the massive, flat head. Its tail swung from side to side, flicking the black tuft like a metronome. And then it extended its neck and humped its shoulders, lowering and opening its jaws, so that the long ivory fangs gleamed in the moonlight like daggers, and it roared again. All the ferocity and cruelty of Africa seemed to be distilled into that dreadful blast. Though she had read the descriptions of the travellers and hunters, they could not prepare her for the actuality. The blast seemed to crush in her chest, so that her heart checked and her lungs seized. It loosened her bowels and her bladder, so she had to clench fiercely to keep control of herself. In her arms, Shasa screeched and wriggled, and that was enough to jar Santan out of a paroxysm of terror. The lion was an old red tom, an outcast from the pride. His teeth and claws were worn, his skin scarred and almost bald across the shoulders. In the succession battle with the young prime male who had driven him from the pride, he had lost one eye. A hooked claw had ripped it from the socket. He was sick and starving, his ribs racked out under his scraggy hide, and in his hunger he had attacked a porcupine 3 days before. A dozen long, poisonous, barbed quills had driven deeply into his neck and cheeks, and were already suppurating and festering. He was old and weak and uncertain, his confidence shattered, and he was wary of man and the man odour. His ancestral memories, his own long experience, had warned him to stay clear of these strange, frail, upright creatures. His roarings were symptoms of his nervousness and uncertainty. There was a time when, as hungry as he was now, he would have gone in swiftly and silently. Even now his jaws had the strength to crunch through a skull or thigh bone, and a single blow of one massive forepaw could shatter a man's spine. However, he hung back, circling the prey. Perhaps if there had been no moon, he would have been bolder, or if he had ever eaten human flesh before, or if the agony of the buried quills had been less crippling, but now he roared indecisively. Santan leaped to her feet. It was instinctive. She had watched the old black stable tomcat at Mortom with the mouse, and his reflex action to his victim's attempted flight. Somehow, she knew that to run would be to bring the great cat down on her immediately. She screamed, and holding the pointed stave high, she rushed straight at the lion. He whirled and galloped off through the grass 50 paces, and then stopped and looked back at her, lashing his tail from side to side, and he growled with frustration. Still facing him, clutching Shasa under one arm and the stave in the other hand, Santan backed away. She glanced over her shoulder. The nearest mapani tree stood isolated from the rest of the forest. It was straight and sturdy, with a fork high above the ground, but it seemed to be at the other end of the earth from where she stood. "We mustn't run, Shasa," she whispered, and her voice shook. "Slowly, slowly now." Her sweat was running into her eyes, though she shivered wildly with cold and terror. The lion circled around towards the forest, swinging its head low, ears pricked, and she saw the gleam of his single eye, like the flash of a knife blade. "We must get to the tree, Shasa," and the infant whined and kicked on her hip. The lion stopped, and she could hear it sniffing. "Oh God, it's so big!" Her foot caught, and she almost fell. The lion rushed forward, grunting terrible exhalations of sound like the pistons of a locomotive, and she screamed and waved the stave. The lion stopped, but this time stood its ground, facing her, lowering its great shaggy head threateningly and lashing the long, black-tipped tail. And when Santan began to back away, it moved forward, slinking low to the earth.
"The tree, Shasa. We must reach the tree."
The lion started to circle again, and Santan glanced up at the moon. There was another dark blot of cloud trundling down from the north.
"Please don't cover the moon," she whispered brokenly.
She realized how their lives depended on that soft, uncertain light. She instinctively knew how bold the great cat would become in darkness. Even now its circles were becoming narrower. It was working in, still cautious and wary, but watching her and perhaps beginning to realize how utterly helpless she truly was. The final killing charge was only seconds away. Something hit her from behind, and she shrieked and almost fell, before she realized that she had walked backwards into the base of the mapani tree. She clung to it for support, for her legs could not hold her, so intense was her relief. Shaking so much that she almost dropped it, she unslung the leather satchel from her shoulder and tipped the ostrich egg bottles out of it. Then she pushed Shasa feet first into the bag, so only his head protruded, and slung him over her back. Shasa was red-faced and yelling angrily.
"Be quiet, please be quiet."
She snatched up her stave again and stuck it into her rope belt like a sword. She jumped to catch the first branch above her head, and she got a hold and scrambled with her bare feet for a grip on the rough bark. She would never have believed it possible, but in desperation she found untapped reserves, and she hauled herself and her load upwards by the main strength of arms and legs and crawled onto the branch. She was only 5 feet above the ground, and the lion grunted fearsomely and made a short rush forward. She teetered on the branch and reached up for another hold, and then another. The bark was rough and abrasive as crocodile skin, and her fingers and shins were bleeding by the time she scrambled into the fork of the mapani 30 feet above the ground. The lion smelled the blood from her grazed skin, and it drove him frantic with hunger. He roared and prowled around the base of the mapani, stopping to sniff at the ostrich eggs that Santan had dropped, and then roaring again.
"We are safe, Shasa."
Santan was sobbing with relief, crouched in the high fork, holding the child on her lap and peering down through the leaves and branches onto the broad, muscled back of the old lion. She realized that she could see more clearly. The light of dawn was flushing the eastern sky. She could clearly make out the great cat was a gingery reddish color, and unlike the drawings she had seen, his mane was not black, but the same ruddy color.
"Oa called them red devils," she remembered, hugging Shasa and trying to still his outraged yells. "How long until it's light?"
She looked anxiously to the east and saw the dawn coming in a splendor of molten copper and furnace reds.
"It will be day soon, Shasa," she told him. "Then the beast will go away."
Below her, the lion reared up on its hind legs and stood against the trunk, looking up at her.
"One eye. He's got only one eye."
The black scarred socket somehow made the other glowing yellow eye more murderous, and Santan shuddered wildly. The lion ripped at the trunk of the tree with the claws of both front feet, erupting into those terrible, crackling roars once more. It ripped slabs and long shreds of bark from the trunk, leaving wet wounds weeping with sap. "Go away!" Santan screamed at it, and the lion gathered itself on its hindquarters and launched itself upwards, hooking with all 4 feet. "No! Go away!" Michael had told her, and she had read in Levalent, that lions did not climb trees. But this great red cat came swarming up the trunk and then pulled itself onto the main branch 10 feet above the ground and balanced there, staring up at her.
"Shessa!"
She realized that the lion was going to get her. Her climb had merely delayed the moment.
"We've got to save you, Shessa."
She dragged herself upward, standing in the fork, and clutching the side branch.
"There!"
Above her head there was a broken branch that stuck out like a hat peg, and using all that remained of her strength, she lifted the rawhide bag with Shessa in it and hooked the strap over the peg.
"Goodbye, my darling," she panted. "Perhaps Annie will find you."
Shessa was struggling and kicking. The bag swung and twisted, and Santan sank back on the fork and drew the sharpened stave from her belt.
"Be still, baby. Please be still."
She did not look up at him. She was watching the lion below her.
"If you are quiet, it might not see you. It might be satisfied."
The lion stretched up with its forelegs, balancing on the branch, and roared again. She smelt it now, the stink of its festering wounds and the dead carrion reek of its breath, and then the beast hurled itself upwards. With its claws ripping the bark, clinging with all 4 paws, it came up in a series of convulsive leaps. Its head was thrown back, its single yellow eye fastened on Santan, and with those monstrous explosions of sound bursting up out of its gaping pink jaws, it came straight at her. Santan screamed, and drove the point of her stave down into the jaws with all her strength. She felt the sharpened end bite into the soft pink mucous membrane in the back of its throat, saw the spurt of scarlet blood, and then the lion locked its jaws on the stave, and with a toss of its flying mane ripped it out of her hands and sent it windmilling out and down to hit the earth below. Then, with the bright blood streaming from its jaws, blowing a pink cloud every time it roared, the lion reached up with one huge paw. Santan jackknifed her legs upwards, trying to avoid it, but she was not quick enough. One of the curved yellow claws, as long and thick as a man's forefinger, sank into her flesh above her bare ankle, and she was jerked savagely downwards. As she was pulled out of the fork, she flung both her arms around the side branch, and with all her remaining strength she held on. She felt her whole body racked, drawn out, the unbearable weight of the lion stretching her leg, until she felt her knee and hip joint crack, and pain shot up her spine and filled her skull like a bursting skyrocket. She felt the lion's claw curling in her flesh, and her arms started to give way. Inch by inch, she was drawn out of the tree.
"Look after my baby," she screamed. "Please, God, protect my baby."